These are amazing questions. Number one, here we go, about rebirth. Does it mean that we know what our sex, boy or girl, before we enter the womb? Can we choose our sex? Thanks, Ajahn Brahm. Yes, you can. You can choose to be monk. That's the best choice of all. That's actually why in Thai, there were three genders. Male, female, monk, nun. Actually, they're called a different gender, totally. So it's very interesting. That's the samana gender. So that's why on these airports, I really think they should have male toilets, female toilets, and monk toilets. It's very confusing. I travel around a lot, and sometimes they don't write English on the outside, so you have to look at the figures outside to see which toilet you should go into. And I look at the figures, and I look at me, and I go in the wrong toilet. That's not true. I made it up, but it's a good thing. Basically, it's to get reborn. this is basically how it works. There's two things, there's two requirements. The wanting to get reborn in this world or another world or in this gender or that gender, and having the karmic causes for that as well. Just like if you want to go overseas, if you want to go to Paris, say, the only way you can get to Paris is, number one, you want to go there, and number two, you've got enough money to get a ticket. So those are two, like the money to get a ticket is like the karma, and the wanting to get there is your craving, your desire. So that's why if you want to be a girl, and you've got the karmic causes to be a girl, then you become a girl. Want to become a boy? Karmic causes to become a boy? Become a boy. Want to become a monk? Karmic causes to be a monk? Then you become a monk. So yeah, you can actually choose your gender. So how many girls here want to be girls in your next life? And how many want to be boys? How many boys want to be girls? These are very dodgy questions. Good fun to ask that question. When I ask a question, keep your hands down. You get into trouble. Dear Bhante, how important is solitude during a retreat? It's helpful in a retreat because sometimes you're with other people all the rest of your lives and being by yourself, no one else there. But there is someone else there. And who's that? You. Wherever I go, I try to find solitude, but wherever I go, I'm there. It's amazing. You go overseas and there I am again. So there's always someone there, and that's you. So solitude is very good, and so I love solitude. You know why I love solitude? Because when I'm by myself, I'm with my very best friend. Me. Which is one of the reasons I never get lonely. Even that one time I went on this retreat for 6 months when I never spoke to any human being. I never saw anybody for 6 months. Total solitude for 6 months, but I was never lonely. I was with me. And I've got a very good relationship to myself. So I'm my best friend. So if you are your best friend, if you have loving kindness towards yourself, when you are alone, you never feel lonely. And that's the trick to solitude. If you don't like yourself, if you have a bad relationship to yourself, if you haven't mended all those bridges of guilt and anger towards oneself, then when you're by yourself, you're with this person you don't really trust, and you're afraid of, and maybe you don't even like. And that makes solitude very, very difficult. But when you've got this beautiful relationship to yourself with your best friend, you tell each other jokes. I reverse all my... I tell all those jokes to myself and laugh. So you've got this great relationship with yourself, which means that when I'm by myself, I have a great time. Then solitude becomes a beautiful time. Time to spend with you. Because sometimes you have to spend so much time with other people, sometimes you don't spend enough quality time with yourself and with your body. So I like spending some quality time with myself. And I love that. The reason is because I'm not afraid of myself. I've got a very good relationship to myself. And then solitude is very, very good. That's why I'm never, ever afraid of getting sent to jail for something I didn't do. Because whenever I want to have a retreat, you just punch a prison officer on the nose and you get solitary confinement for 3 months. Retreat! Brilliant! Dear Ajahn, I'm a little confused about nimittas. Is it the mind or the soul, conscious beams? So if I'm looking at it, doesn't that mean I am not it or I have to be something else to see it? Thanks. Okay. Now this idea of a soul. You can call it a soul if you wish, as long as you realize it's always constantly changing. So it's never the same from one moment to the next. That's why the word a stream or a river is a much more accurate description than a soul. A soul is a thing. A stream is this flow of experience, like the flow of water. Never the same one moment to the next, but it looks the same. That's why the stream or the river is a beautiful simile for this thing we call a soul or a self, the stream of consciousness, me or whatever. So, then what the nimitta is that stream of consciousness. You're taking a looking at it in a mirror, and that's what it looks like. That's the not the whole of the stream of consciousness, that's the knowing part of the mind, that which knows. And you're actually seeing it as if in a mirror. And if that part of yourself is very happy and very beautiful, then your nimitta is really beautiful and shiny and bright. But if you've been a naughty person, when you see your nimitta, it's all dirty and grubby. Because that happened, that's actually true. That's one of the things about the nimitta, this light, which when it comes up, if it is brilliant and beautiful and bright, well done. It means you're a very virtuous, good, kind person. But sometimes I told this, first time I said this in a public talk, this young man from Malaysia came up and he was so concerned. Because he said, I just saw my nimitta and it was dirty. It was all like stained, like a dirty, oily cloth. I said, what have you been doing? He said, yes, exactly. Because that's actually seeing your mind. And if you've been negative, angry, sort of selfish or whatever, then that's what you see, that's how it appears. So here you cannot hide it anymore. And that illustrates the importance of like keeping things like precepts, being kind, being generous, being compassionate. Because that actually is one great way of shining up that nimitta, making it brilliant and beautiful. And I know that so well now. There are some people like Help Out Love Buddha Society in Perth, and they're always there helping out. You know, if there's some fundraising, they're always very happy to give a donation. They're always happy to stand for a committee, always happy to be there and help out, you know, it's cleaning up or doing whatever. What you really think or call pure-hearted people. And I've known enough of those, and when they come and meditate, when their nimitta comes up, it's really beautiful. Now these are the sort of people you say are really beautiful people. You know, pure-hearted, kind, generous, always there to help out. Those pure-hearted people, when they see their nimitta, it's gorgeous. And they deserve it. They work for it. That's where virtue, compassion, kindness, generosity get one of their payoffs. And because I've seen that so many times, you know, people I've known for so many years, and when they get their first nimitta, they come and say, oh, it's beautiful. I say, yes, of course, because you've been a beautiful person for many years. And that really also tells me why it's important to be a good, virtuous, generous, kind person. Because that's the thing you see when you die. And you can't hide it. If you've been a really good, kind, beautiful person, your nimitta when you die, the light you see is gorgeous, amazing. But if you know you have been selfish, you know, naughty, whatever, then it's a bit dirty. But don't worry, we can fix that for you. Forgive, let go of the past. You know, as I've been saying, you can forgive almost anything. To let it go here and now, then you don't have to worry
about it in the future. So, you know, get rid of the dirty stuff so that then you can just have the beautiful stuff in your nimitta. The light you see when you die will be gorgeous. You get a good rebirth. Next question. This is a comment. Smiling really helps. Yeah, it does. So that's another way to shine up your nimitta when you're dying. You're about to die. Smile. Then you get a bright light when you die. It really does help. So smile a lot. And you will have a happy whatever you do. Bhante, you quote Ajahn Chah as saying, there is nothing. How do avijja, which is delusion, and tanha, craving, spring out of nothingness? I.e., how does involution occur? How do things come out of nothing? It's very simple to know that. This is called Hawking radiation. You know that? That's Stephen Hawking. That's one of the reasons why he became famous. It's a part of the reason why black holes disappear. This is theoretical physics. What happens is, because it can, they can have this spontaneous particle creation. It happens all the time, because it can. It's just Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, because you can have just a little bit of a tweak and an imbalance just for a small amount of time. And because it can, it does. And one of those particles goes into the black hole, the other one goes out. And there is radiation, the creation of things out of nothing. That is happens. Where does this universe come from? That was always a question people asked Buddhists. Because the Christians say it came from God or whatever. So the Buddhists, where did this universe come from? Because it's a basic law of science. You may not know quantum physics, but I'm sure you know the basic law of science. You cannot create energy. The mass energy is a constant. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So where did all this energy come from? We call our universe. And the answer is pretty simple. There is physics, not just positive energy, there is something called negative energy. An example of that is what you learnt at school as potential energy. You've got a massive object in a gravitational field like this cup in the gravity of this earth. For me to take this cup and free it from the earth, to take it into orbit, takes so much energy. So this is actually a negative energy component to any massive object. And so any object in a field, gravitational field, electric field, or one of these nuclear energy fields, that has a negative component to it. And I pose this to the local professor of physics at UWA, Professor David Blair. And I asked him, what if the amount of negative energy in this universe totally equal, balance the positive energy in this universe? So the sum total of energy in this universe was zero. And I asked that question, remember, a few years ago in a talk we were given. And he turned around to me and he said, my goodness, you're up to date. And he said, omega equals one. You know, in physics, they have all these Greek letter names for these constants. They say, yeah, it does equal one. It balances totally. And that's modern science. In this universe, the sum total of energy is zero. That's why it can come from nothing. Because there's nothing here. Ajahn Chah was right. There is nothing. Just a balance. And this is physical. It's not emotional or good energy, bad energy. This is hard physics energy. It's zero. Wow. So that's how these things come from.
How does nothing tie in with
dependent arising? Yes. That means you can't know. They actually say, you can't say there is. You can't say there is not. And even saying there is nothing. Is there nothing? Or is there not something? You can't say there is. You can't say there is not.
That's why you really get lovely and confused here. Because I love that story, another Alice in Wonderland story. When Alice arrived at the place where the Red Queen lived, she came and the Red Queen said, "Oh, look, I've been waiting for my messenger. Did you see the messenger on the road as you were coming?" And Alice said, "I saw nobody on the road." And then soon, and the Queen said, "You saw nobody on the road? You've got such good eyes. It's hard for me to see somebody on the road, let alone to see nobody." And then soon the messenger came, and the Queen said, "You're so slow." And he said, "No, I'm not slow, I'm very fast. Nobody walks faster than me." "Exactly, because nobody got here before you." And they made this big joke about making nobody into a somebody. And that's the problem. You know, nothing. There is nothing. We make nothing into nirvana, a place where you can go to and live happily ever after. You make you into a somebody. But there's a nobody. But you make nobody into somebody. That's why sometimes, some time ago, people asked me to say, "Ajahn Brahm, how should we address you?" And my favorite way of address is, "Your emptiness." So that's a great way. So your emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. And when you go, you know, get a bit more attained, it's your very emptiness. Your extreme emptiness. Your absolute nothingness. Do you like to be a nobody or a somebody? That's a bit nice being a nobody, rather than a somebody. That's why, if you read my latest book, The Art of Disappearing, I said the whole purpose of being a Buddhist and meditating is to let go of things, to abandon things, to lose things. So Buddhists are the biggest losers. And especially in light, the Buddha was the biggest loser. So do you want to be a loser? Yeah, I'm a loser. The thing is that people think, "Oh, losers, they're really down there in the bottom of the pile. You're a loser." And that's a term of abuse. But when people come and tell me, "Ajahn Brahm, you're a loser," I say, "Yes, isn't it great? Thank you for giving me one of the nicest bits of praise I've ever received." So you're disappearing, you're vanishing, you're gone. So that's what sort of, there's nothing there, actually is. And sometimes people make nothing into a something. And that's a problem. A quick follow-up. Last night you said, "Metta meditation can lead to full enlightenment." Curious why in the Karaniya Matta Sutta, the last stanza only mentions Sotapanna, Anagami, and not Arahat. Oh, it's because that's only by not holding to false views. In other words, you understand that there is no self. And by not attaching to the five sense pleasures, the five senses, you get to anagami. But even if you get to a non-returner, it's that close to becoming enlightened. You go to this pseudo-asa, have a nice time, and then from there you become fully enlightened. So it still leads to enlightenment. It's just, you know, you've got a little halfway house before you finish off. So still, would you like to be an anagami, non-returner? Then you have a lovely time, lots of happiness and peace, and then you just disappear totally. Nice way to go out. So you still go to enlightenment. By that time, there's no other possibility. So that's in the Metta Sutta. So they only go up to anagami, but the rest is assumed. Has to happen. No way back. That's why I call it a non-returner. You can't come back. It's a one-way street. A one-way ticket. Do you want a one-way ticket, or do you like return tickets? One-way. Do you really want? You know where you're going? That's the problem with enlightenment. Everyone wants to get enlightened, but they don't actually know where it is or what it is. Have you ever gone on a bus not knowing where the destination is? Do you know what nirvana is? Are you really going to be happy when you get there? Do you really know? That's really scary, isn't it? We're doing all these things, and if you go too far, you'll become enlightened. Do I really want to be enlightened? What it's like when I get there? So that actually scared me once when I thought, gee, I'm a Buddhist monk. I'm supposed to be coming enlightened, and I don't know where it is or what it is. It's totally ridiculous. So that's why, you know, you wanted to find out what it is. And it reminded me of this story when I started to get interested in religion. That was when I was at school. Because I went to a good school, all scholarships. I came from a very poor family. And at this school, there was a chaplain. It was an Anglican school. So I went up to the guy, and I was about 16 or something, and I asked him, look, you know, I just want to find out this God, what actually is God? Now tell me, you know, describe it. And then the chaplain said, like, God is like the ineffable, beyond words, transcendental, you know, the Alpha and Omega, beyond words, beginning and end of all things. And that never made any sense to me. What do you mean ineffable? What the heck is that? What do you mean the Alpha and Omega? Is it some like street directory or a dictionary or something? What do you mean beyond words? And to me, because he couldn't explain it, I thought he didn't know what he was talking about. And that's actually quite true. Most people, they believe in God, but they haven't got a clue what God is. They can't explain it to other people, let alone themselves. It's just some wispy sort of idea. You try and pin them down, you try and pin it down yourself, and you just don't know what you're talking about. So that's one of the reasons why I gave up sort of believing in any type of God. Because nobody can tell me what I'm supposed to be believing in. And then I became a Buddhist. And then I went to one of the monks, I think in the Thai temple in London, asked him, what's Nirvana? And that's when he said, it's ineffable, transcendental, beyond words, the beginning and end of all things. And I thought, I've heard that before. You don't know what you're talking about either. And it's true, a lot of people don't even, can't explain Nirvana. And that might be you. You might go home. And your grandma or your sort of your son might ask you, you know, mummy, grandma, you know, what's Nirvana mean? And you can't give a good answer. You feel stupid, don't you? And you're a Buddhist and you've been trying to get to Nirvana, but you haven't got a clue what it is. So because of that, that's why we give this beautiful little anecdote, which some of you have heard before, but it is a delightful anecdote of the meaning of Nirvana. And it's a story of the five children playing the wishing game, which goes like this. The children were playing this little competition. They had a wish, and the child who came up with the best wish would win the wishing game. So the first child, 6 or 7 years of age, said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a new computer game, because he loved computer games. Very good. The next child, who had a bit more time to think, said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a computer game shop. Because if I own the shop, I could have many computer games, not the ones which are there now. If I own the shop, when new ones come out, I can get those as well. So that was obviously a superior wish, the one who had the computer game shop. And the third child was far smarter. She was thinking, and she said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $100 billion. Because with $100 billion, I could have, first of all, I'd buy my own computer shop. But the problem is, my mummy won't let me play computer games because she says I must do my homework. So, after I bought my own computer shop, the next thing I'll buy is my own school. Because if I own the school, I won't need to go, and I can still give myself the top marks, you know, because I employ the principal and all the teachers, so they have to do what I say. And then when I graduate from my own school, when I'm old enough, then I'll buy my own university and give myself a degree, because I own the place. But that way I can play computer games all day, and no one can stop me. And with $100 billion, you know, when I grow up, when there's something else I want, $100 billion, you can't spend that in a whole lifetime. And obviously that's a very, very superior wish. And there's two children left. And the fourth child got a much better wish than $100 billion. Don't say $200 billion or $300 billion, because $100 billion is more money you can ever spend. So it's no different to say $200 or $300 billion. That's not the better wish. That's the same. So the fourth child thought, and he said, I've got a better wish than that. I wish for three wishes. That's my wish. That's a wish. And for my first wish, I'll have the computer game store. The second wish, I'll have $100 billion. And for my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. So that was the infinity of wishes. Wish. How can you get better than that? And the last kid won the wishing game and said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. And that won the wishing game. And that little story tells the difference between what we call the freedom of desires, the infinity of wishes granted in your life. When you want something, you can eventually get it. The freedom of desire. And the last kid, the freedom from desire. So content you don't want anything. That is nirvana. That's enlightenment. The end of craving. So content you don't want anything anymore. Now you can explain, even to your little grandchild, what nirvana is. And they get it. And they understand why most people in this world, they pursue the freedom of desires. And heaven is a place where once you go to heaven, whatever you want, you can get. Anytime. That's the freedom of desires. Nirvana is not like a heaven. It's the freedom from desires. So content, you don't need anything. Very brilliant story. Ah, here we go. Venerabilist Ajahn Brahm. Is meditation good for a hangover? No, for a hangover, medication. Meditation. It's much better. But look, if you try meditation, you've got a hangover. You won't even be able to keep on the red carpet. You'll be going off this carpet this way and off that carpet that way. So very good question. How do you explain the Buddha's initial decision not to teach the Dharma, then relenting at the request of Brahma Sahampati? The Buddha quote, if I were to teach the Dharma and if others would not understand me, that would be tiresome for me, troublesome for me. Is it possible for one free from suffering and a living embodiment of the Brahma Vihara sects? Okay. Now, no one was actually there to record the Buddha said, oh, it would be troublesome for me, but there is a kernel of truth to that experience, because when a person has become so enlightened, you're so still, your will, craving has been totally eradicated, there's no reason to do anything. That's why you need a bit of conditioning outside. Someone just to ask you, please teach. That's all you need. Someone to teach, to ask you, and then you can teach. If you understand the nature of this thing called the will, where it comes from, it's not free will. The Buddha didn't have any choice. His will was totally, basically eradicated. All you need is someone to say, would you teach? So, yeah, sure. And then we had our Buddha. That's why it's very difficult sometimes after meditation. Sometimes you get so still, it's hard to get out of meditation. It's hard to get off your seat because there's nothing sort of to motivate you. Just so peaceful, so happy, freedom from desires. Just so content, you don't want to do anything. So for me, it's not the fact that he thought it was troublesome. The contentment was so strong, it just needed someone to ask. It's just, I've been waiting for you to ask. Thank you. Then I can teach. So that's what I really think happened. Just needed someone just to put in that seed there to teach. Next question. This is in love to the crows at Jhana Grove. They are so beautiful in their black and white outfit, but it's their vocal entertainment I have come to cherish. Sitting down in this hall, they put a smile on my face right in time for sinking in. Maybe consider to call them ha-ha Jhana crows. You talk to Danya. You know why those bricks are in front of the windows? Because they keep pooing in front of the windows. And this lady has to wipe up the poo.
And hitting, and then there's blood in front of the...
Yeah. There's They're not sort of ha-ha jhana crows, they're psychotic crows. They really need to see a therapist. That's why the bricks are in there, because, you know, these birds, they see their reflections in the window and they're so stupid they go and attack them. Just like sometimes you see your reflection, you attack it. Get out of here, I don't like me, I don't want that. So just let it go. But anyway, yeah, they're nice crows. They belong here. The hindrance karma chandra is often translated as sensory desire to sense, desire for sense pleasures. But does it really mean something broader, desire of any kind, including desire for achieving progress in meditation? Okay, I'll just answer that one first of all. It's like the karma chandra. This word karma, it refers to the five sense world. And this is a very beautiful part of Buddhism from the very early times. They made a distinction between the world of the five senses, this is the world you know about, and the other two worlds or universes or realms, the Rupa Loka and the Arupa Loka. The Rupa Loka is the jhana realm, and the Arupa the immaterial realms. And they say that there's a huge amount beyond the world of the five senses, which most people know about. And the world of the five senses is what we call this universe. Which is why when this universe stops, now the end of this universe, the big whimper or the big crunch, whatever happens, and before the next big bang, they say, well, you know, this five sense world has disappeared. Where do people go? And basically, you know, they go to those jhana realms or the immaterial realms. You know, the Rupa Loka or the Arupa Loka, which is totally independent of the physical world. And that's where beings come into, you know, in the beginning of this universe cycle. So it's a very profound idea of the nature of existence to see this much more than just this physical world. But most of our craving and desire is on the world we know, the worlds of sights, sounds, tastes, smells and touches, basically the thing which makes this world go round. So all of that, you know, including just wanting to have, you know, a healthy body, a peaceful body, now all of that is to do with karma chanda. And it's concern from this body and this world. And to get into this deep meditation, you just have to put that aside for a while. You know, forget about your family and your finances and the food and the jhana grove and the crows and everything else. Just let it all disappear. And you know you've let go when these things disappear. So that's what the karma chandra is. It just gets rid of all of the messing around with the body and the senses. And nekama is often translated as renunciation of sense pleasure, but the way you translate it as making peace indicates it means a broader renunciation of all desires, correct? Yeah, I do translate it like that. The nekama, and it is like a renunciation, not just renunciation of the five senses, it's letting renunciation of all cravings, that's a beautiful thing to do. So what you're really letting go of, and this is the most important part of the meditation, you're letting go of that thing which controls your meditation, the driver of your vehicle. That's what you're letting go of. Because if you let go of the wrong things, then nothing ever happens. My little simile, which I thought I made up, was a simile of the hand. Because I noticed, you know, just the way you fidget with things. I'm always picking things up. Come, put it down, Ajahn Brock. A few moments later, I'll pick up something else. Come on, put it down. That's what was happening in my life, because I noticed when I became a monk, I gave up sex. You know, not, I was celibate, that's what you have to do. And then you started eating a lot. And so I'd given up sex, but then I sort of started getting attached to food. So, you know, stop eating so much. And then you got attached to something else, you know, tea or sweet drinks or something. And I found it so difficult to let go of things. You let go of one attachment, you pick up another attachment. You let that one go, you pick up something else. Have you ever noticed that in life? You know, you let go of one addiction, you get another addiction. And so I thought, what's going on here? And I said, it's a simile of the hand. If you've got a hand, it's its nature. It picks up things. That's what a hand does. I said, that's the only way to stop my hand picking up things is cut off my hand. If I don't have a hand, I won't pick up things. And it's the same with the attachment. The only way to stop attaching to things is to cut off that thing which keeps picking it up. The driver, the doer, the controller. That's what we let go of. When you let go of that source, the driver, the controller, the doer,
the one in charge of you, then you don't attach to anything anymore. That's called nekama, the real renouncing, letting go of this owner and doer. But even though one knows in theory that it's a trap to want the next stage in meditation, it's really hard to outsmart that insidious wanting. I try to see the wanting, but it still keeps lurking in there. Please advise, thank you. So what you do, you don't try and see it, you outwit it. And how you outwit the knower, or the doer rather, is through bliss, through joy. So, yeah, you don't really want the next stage of meditation, but, you know, bliss is very attractive. Peace is very nice. So, you know, you've already heard, to get the next stage of peace, you have to just let go. So you let go, you know, to get the reward, the little sweet of, you know, a nice bit of joy and peace. And then to get the next reward of peace and joy, you've got to let go a little bit more. And then you get let go a little bit more. It's just like, you know, you leave this trail of sweets on the ground, you know, which, you know, draw you closer and closer and closer into the monastery to become a monk or become a nun. If I said become a monk, no way. But if I put a little sweet over here and you go a little bit further, another little sweet, you go a little bit further. You understand what I'm up to? And that's how I outsmart you. And that's how you stop the wanting, little by little. It is the joy and the happiness which draw you in. It's profound, this joy of happiness, the joy of truth. Just the happiness that this is real. And that keeps drawing you in. And eventually, you have to let go. That insidious wanting, you let it go because you get rewards. Peace, freedom, happiness. It's worth it. Yeah. Craving for the jhanas is a hindrance. What it really is a hindrance to getting the jhanas in the first place. So that's the biggest thing. If you want them, you can't get them. But there is a way around that, as it usually is. You aspire for them. So aspiring is a bit less intense than wanting. So what you do is, yeah, I mean, that's what you're here for. Yeah, I want the jhanas. Now, how do I get the jhanas? I want them. How do I get the jhanas? I have to let go and be peaceful. So you let go and be peaceful, and that is your road into the jhanas. You let go of all wanting, let go of all wanting, let go of all wanting, because that's how to get to jhanas. It's similar to what I said to someone earlier, the simile of the taxi driver. Similarly, the taxi driver is this, you know, that when you leave here, you have to go to the airport. So you book a taxi, and they get in the taxi at the car park outside the kitchen, and you tell the taxi driver, please take me to Perth Airport. Now, I'm a Buddhist, so please make sure that you don't hit any birds or even any insects, so drive very slowly. But not too slowly, because I've got to get there in time. But don't speed, because, you know, I'm very sensitive after a meditation retreat. Please don't do that horn, because, you know, I've been into silence for the last 9 days. That will really hurt me. And turn down your radio, because I like to meditate on the way to the airport. But be compassionate. If anybody wants to come in front, you know, let them come in front. I'm paying for this, so you should be compassionate, because I'm in charge of the taxi now. And please, you know, don't swerve too much this way or too much that way. And if you gave all those instructions to a taxi driver like that, he'll throw you out before you get to the gate. You can't do that to a taxi driver. All you do to a taxi driver is say, take me to Perth Airport. They know how to get you there. They'll get you there in their way. That's all. Exactly what you do to the mind. You say, take me to jhana. And then you let go. The mind will know how to do that, but you have to let go. And don't keep on giving more commands. So you make the aspiration, you're going to jhana, and then you know what to do. Let go. You've heard all the information. You're totally brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm and other teachers. Just let it happen. But our mistake is we keep interfering with the taxi driver. Always giving you, and that's the craving, which interferes with the process. Similar to the simile of the cup.
The way to get it still is put it down. So I want this to be still, so I let go. And I have to leave it alone. Every time I want it to be still, I try and hold it to make it go still faster. That is the craving which causes the problem. Does that sort of answer you? Sort of? That's all you're going to get, so don't crave for more. Sort of? Ah, okay, that's a very good one. Not in Karma Chanda. Let's say that this is a very interesting point. The three cravings in the Second Noble Truth. So in the Second Noble Truth, of the Four Noble Truths, that the craving leads to suffering, leads to more rebirth as well. And the Buddha says those first cravings. Yayang Danha, Pono Bhavika, Nadi Ragata, Tatratratrabhinandini, Sayakidan, Karma Danha, Bhava Danha, Vibhava Danha. And the Karma Danha is a craving for the five sense world. Bhava Danha is a craving to be, to exist. And the craving to not exist is Vibhava Danha. And people have realized there's nothing there about the cravings for the jhanas. That's not included in there. You know why? Because it does not lead to suffering. Attaining the jhanas is leading out of samsara. That's why it's not in there. It's a craving, yes, but it doesn't lead to more rebirth. It leads to the end of rebirth. That's a technical point. That's a very good point. Okay. Dear Ajahn. Oh, no, it didn't say that. Dear lovely Ajahn, yes. Okay, my frustration has set in today. Congratulations. See if you can beat your PB on frustration. Because the trouble is, when we're frustrated, frustration isn't a problem. It's not wanting to be frustrated is a problem. And I'm frustrated at being frustrated. I don't want to be frustrated, so be frustrated. Get off on it. At best, I can get about 2 minutes continuous good meditation. I need a cuddle. Well, you're not going to get a cuddle from me, but there is a rabbit in this. Two rabbits. So go and cuddle the rabbit. So that's it. That's how we've got a couple of rabbits. Have you still got the rabbit around?
I'll bring him for a walk tomorrow evening.
So tomorrow evening, you see the rabbit. And anyone who's really frustrated, you can cuddle that poor rabbit. Squash it to bits. Is being jealous and envy part of the process of meditation? How does the Sangha deal with it, especially during young age? How can one transform these negative emotions into a beneficial act of kindness? Thank you, Ajahn. You are both sharp and sensible. Really? Okay. Jealous and envy. When I was a young monk, they used to pass the food down the line. Now you see, even now, I'm the first one who gets the first choice of the food. But there's heaps of food here, so it's not really a big deal. There's plenty left for everybody. But in those days, you'd have very little amount of food. And the head monk got the first choice. By the time he got to me at the end of the line, there's hardly anything left. And I always thought that was so unfair. Because those senior monks were so fat. And I was really thin when I was. Not only that, but those senior monks are already enlightened. I have my craving. I needed to have another nice food because I still have craving. You know, give nice food to an arahat is just wasted on them. So I thought, you know, I should have the first choice of the food because, you know, I've got defilements. I can appreciate nice food. You know, I still got defilements and I was very thin. And those senior monks, they didn't have to do work like I had to do work. They just sat there all day talking to people, you know, drinking tea. And I was really jealous of those senior monks. And not only that, we had to sit on the concrete. And those senior monks had all the fat cushions.
They didn't need fat cushions, they had natural upholstery. Really unfair. I was really jealous of them. They got the best food, the best cushions, they didn't have to work. Now I'm a senior monk. Now I've got natural upholstery. And I'm so jealous of those young monks. They don't have to answer all these questions. They don't have to sit there and people coming to ask all these interview questions. They don't have to sort of give all these talks and answer all the emails and answer all the... No, there's people actually call me up from overseas, and you know, even this evening somebody was upset and they wanted chanting over the phone. It's dial-a-monk service. They don't give any. They ring up and say, look, I'm having trouble with my dog, I'm having trouble with my wife, can you please give me counselling, all for free. And I have to be there in a half an hour and I'm really tired and oh, it's really tough being. These young monks, they just chat around having a time and then afterwards they just go back and enjoy themselves, not me. So now I'm really jealous of these younger monks. They just have it so easy. They don't have to work very hard. They can meditate all day and sleep whenever they want. They don't have to answer all these questions. But then the answer to the question is this. When you're a young monk, you've got what we call young monk suffering. Now, you have to sit on hard floors. You know, you don't get the first choice of the food. You don't get the thick cushions. You've got young monk suffering. But when you get to be a senior monk, you don't have that young monk suffering anymore. You have old monk suffering. So you don't get rid of anything. You just change the type of suffering. It's the same like when you're single. You know, you're single, you haven't got a partner yet. You've got single woman or single man suffering. So you really want someone to share your life with. And then you find a nice partner. You don't have that single woman or single man suffering anymore. You have married person suffering. And you know what it's like. And then when you've got your partner, like, oh, they drive you crazy sometimes. And you think, oh, if I can only get a divorce or somehow separate, then I'll be happy. And it's true, once you get separated, you don't have married person suffering anymore. You're back to single people suffering again. And some of you think, I've had it with marriage, I've had it with being single, I'm going to become a monk or a nun. And it's true, you don't have marriage suffering, you don't have single person suffering, now you have monk suffering again. So that's what people do, you know, they leave their job. Or they think, when I retire, then I'll be happy. When you retire, you don't have working suffering, you have retired person suffering. You think, you know, okay, I'm going to buy a lottery ticket, I'm going to win the lottery, then I'll be happy. No, it doesn't work that way. You're a poor person, you've got poor people suffering. If you win the lottery, you don't have poor people suffering anymore. What do you have? Rich suffering, yeah. You ask any of these rich people, are they really happy? No, they have suffering, but it's a different type of suffering, a different flavor. So that is the meaning of life. We just change one person type of suffering for another type of suffering. I remember being a kid. I thought, when I grow up, I can do all these things. I can drive a car and go into the pub and do whatever I like. And it's true, as soon as you grow up, you didn't have kids suffering anymore. You had mature person suffering. You just can't escape. Not that way, anyway. So that's why you don't have jealousy anymore. If you see a rich person, don't be jealous. They haven't got your suffering, they've got rich person suffering. If you see a person, that really, really attractive person, and you're ugly, don't be jealous. They've got beautiful person suffering. And look, you know, I've talked to many beautiful... It's great being a monk because you're not in the market for a partner anymore. So you talk to these, there's really beautiful girls, supermodels. You know, I've known a few of those. TV stars, and they got a lot of suffering because they can't relate to anybody. You know, all they see is a body, you know, beautiful, attractive girl, but not a person. They have a lot of suffering if you're, you know, really beautiful and attractive. Being famous, famous people suffering, that's terrible. You can't go anywhere without someone recognizing you. So do you want to be famous? Don't be jealous. You don't want to be, no, rich people want to be poor. Poor people want to be rich. Famous people just want to be ordinary. Ordinary people want to be famous. That's absolutely stupid, and that's the jealousy. So me, I'm just myself, and I'm just happy being me. not jealous of anybody else. That's the best thing to be. That's how we deal with jealousy. Realizing, just if you want to be somebody else, or if you think somebody else is having a good time, no. Just a different type of suffering, that's all. Can we apply the middle way to the air conditioning, please, by adjusting the temperature setting rather than just turning it off altogether? It was roasting in here last night, and I went to bed with heat stress, with particular metta on the aesthetics and Bikram yoga practitioners here. Okay, the middle way is you've got coal person suffering. And if you turn it up, you get hot people suffering. You just can't win. There is no middle way with the temperature, unfortunately. So what you can do, you can find this is serious, that you see those air conditioners, they throw the cold air down or the heat down, so it gets colder in the centre over here. So if you can move to the sides, and that's actually not so cold. So move. Instead of sitting here freezing, find the warm spot, find the hot spot. In monastery, you can always find where the coolest spot of a monastery is by finding where the cat is sleeping. Cats are very wise. If they're cold somewhere, they go somewhere where it's warm. If they're warm, they go somewhere where it's cold. Human beings, they're stupid. We sit here and complain. I think I've made my point. Ajahn, can you please explain the monks and nuns to us? Why do they wear different colour robes? The reason why we wear different colours, the monks over here, we try and wear one colour and the nuns the other. We did this some time ago. Because what happened once, there was one nun came to visit, and I was in town at the time, and this nun, after the meal, she went into a car with another woman. They were going to see some of Perth. And there was this young woman, you know, maybe in her 20s, sitting next to this nun, which is fine. But because her robe was the same colour as my robe, this Thai woman saw, Ajahn Brahm is going out with a young girl. Look, he's in the car. You can see him there. And it was very close. I just happened to come out when she was saying that Ajahn, and she saw me. It wasn't Ajahn Brahm, it was this nun. So it's so easy to get confused because we all look the same in the robes. Bald head, how do you know? So that's why we decided here in Perth, the monks, the men wear this colour, and the nuns wear the darker colour, like Upeka over there. And that means you know who's who. So it makes it much easier for us and for you. You know, this is nun. Otherwise, we have to wear this sign on monk or nun so you know who's who. Now, in the world, it's very easy to know a boy as a girl. You know, the hair, the clothes, and it's very easy to see who's who. But imagine that, you know, you didn't know who's who. Life would be very, very, very difficult. So that's why we have the different colour robes. Oh, that's some of the rest of the other questions. Oh, yeah. Why are they different? Where do they come from? They all come from their mother's womb. Why is... That's when they asked, I think Ajahn Chah went over to the West and somebody asked him, where are you from? He said, my mum's womb. Great answer. So when you go sort of overseas and the immigration person asks, where are you from? I'm from my mother's womb. Why is there the occasional different monk about? Because he's the occasional monk. Somebody asked me that question. Can you be a monk and have Saturday evenings off? Yeah, that's right. You know, so you know, 6 days a week, you know, you're on duty, and on Saturday night you can just go for broke. But no, if you're a monk, you're a monk. You have to behave. So no, these monks come over from the monastery just to have a meditate in here, especially when it's hot. One of our monks came over here today to meditate because he got the air conditioner over here. There's no air conditioning over in Jhana Monastery. So when it gets very hot, they come and sit with you because it's nice and cool. What do they do when they're not on retreat? They They work, they sleep, they meditate, they study, do lots of things. They build Jhana Grove Retreat Center. All of you on that side of this room, that floor was laid by monks. So we work so hard for you. Aha, here we go. I think I know this joke. Two cannibals were eating a clown. One said to the other, "Does this taste funny to you?" When people meditate a lot, they get very silly. That explains me. Last night you mentioned the term stream of consciousness. Please could you explain this? Also, your teacher really is inspiring. Thank you so much. Be careful of inspiration. Because inspiration soon leads to desperation. And then expiration. It's called the spirations. The four inspirations. First you get inspired. Then you get, what's in the next? Inspiration, desperation. There's another one in between. Exasperation, that's right. First you get inspired, so you come on this retreat, you're very inspired. And then it doesn't work, so you get exasperated, the exasperation. Then towards the end of the retreat, you get to desperation. And then you've had enough, you leave, that's called expiration. So it's inspiring. Okay, very good, thank you. Stream of consciousness, that's just the flow of experience you call conscious experience. See, just the whole day it's flowed from this morning to lunch to now. It's a whole flow of conscious experience. It is like a stream going across. Dear Ajahn and all yogis, I have had enough of this retreat and I'm going to pack my stuff and leave. Excellent. I've been trying so hard for the last few days, but nobody has ever paid any attention to me whatsoever. Like, carry on, this is good. Like the other day, I was all day long in the meditation hall trying to tempt the yogis. However, my efforts were fruitless. I've even tried to meditate on that occasion. So bored I was. How can you do that stuff every day? It almost killed me. If someone looks for, I'll be tempting the prisoners down, looks for me, I'll be tempting the prisoners down the road at Karnak Prison. I'll be back. Yours with love, Mara. Now, Mara is this tempter, like this devil. So this is a letter from Mara. Because Mara said, I've had enough of this retreat and I'm going to pack my stuff and leave. So Mara's left. I've been trying so hard for the last few days, but nobody's ever paid any attention to me whatsoever. You haven't paid any attention to Mr. Mara. Like the other day, I was all day long in the meditation hall trying to tempt the yogis. However, my efforts were fruitless. Well done. You've resisted Mara. I've even tried to meditate on that occasion. Mara meditating? So bored I was. How can you guys all do that every day? It almost killed me. If someone looks for me, I'll be up the road at the prison. A letter from Mara. You defeated him. Well done. How do you practice mudita as a meditation object? Is it possible to get to jhana to this meditation object? Yeah, it is. How you do mudita meditation, you get joy out of other people's success. You see somebody meditating there and they meditate so peaceful. Oh, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that wonderful? I feel so happy that someone's meditating here. It's great. So much joy that so many people are happy in this retreat and they're getting up early, they're meditating, they're chanting, that everybody is so happy. You feel so much joy. It's like a freebie, a free gift. You don't have to do joy yourself, you can get off on other people's joy. It's so wonderful to see they're all enlightened except for me. Oh, that just makes me so... It's the opposite of jealousy. You get off on other people's success. Isn't it so wonderful? Just the crows out there have got something to eat. Isn't it so wonderful? The rabbit has got someone to look after them. Isn't it so wonderful? The monks are so happy. The nuns are so happy. So you get joy off other people's happiness. And then you sit down and think, oh, isn't it just wonderful? It's a beautiful retreat center. Everybody's having a good time. So selfless. because all you're thinking about is other people's happiness. And that makes you so peaceful. You don't want anything yourself. You're just happy that other people are happy. You get content when you get peace. You get very still. So don't think about your own meditation. Oh, I'm getting nowhere. That's just so self-centered. Think all these other wonderful people are meditating here. And you think, oh, so many other people having great meditations, wonderful meditations. There's no desire for yourself anymore. You get content, you get peaceful, you get deep in meditation. Right, it's very powerful. In this kind of heat, do the monks and nuns, yourself included, know how to put sunscreen on your heads? I shaved my head once and my whole scalp got burnt and peeled off. So, do we put sunscreen on your heads? Now, well, you know, that's why the Buddha sat under trees, you know, to sort of keep the sun off. So, if you're out there for a long time, then yes, you can put a hat on or something. But, you know, sometimes these monks, they have umbrellas. And the umbrellas, it's not because it's raining. You know, it's actually to keep the bird shit off. We've got bald heads. It's, you know, it's a bit more... But no, it's, you know, sometimes you do that just to keep the sun off your head. Yes, sometimes you have to put sunscreen on your heads. Sometimes you usually put hats on your heads, you know, so that you know you don't get the sort of sun. Over here in Australia, it's obviously very dangerous. So I've got one of these hats, but I don't like that hat. What I really, really want, because it is allowed to wear hats for medicinal purposes, like, you know, to keep the sun off your hat. But no one has ever bought me one of these. Yeah, I want, like, you know, the English top hats, because I was born in England. So that would be very fitting for Ajahn Brahm. It has to be brown colour, of course, a nice big top hat up here somewhere. Can you get me one of those? No, don't do that. I'm only joking. Ah, very good. An Aussie joke. What do koala bears wear? And the answer is gumboots. Gumboots. Okay. Eat gum leaves. Okay. I'd like to share a short story regarding proof of reconciliation. Oh, here we go. My first childhood memory is of myself and a little girl who lived up the road playing together in the backyard of her parents' home. I must have been 3 years old, maybe four, and she was younger, perhaps two. This is not a vision gleaned through meditation, but an actual hardwired memory. We were both discussing reincarnation. The memory stays with me because we were both so matter-of-fact and seemingly grown up in the way we were discussing it. I can't remember the exact words, but I remember explaining to her I was a young spirit, not often reincarnated. She told me she had reincarnated many times. I believed her, and although she was younger than I was acquiescent to her greater wisdom. I have no other memories until normal childhood memories at around 5 years of age. That's very, very nice, because that's true. I mean, sometimes we remember these important things of our childhood, they stick with us. And some of those children, you know, it's not that long ago when you were in your last life. If you're 2 or 3 years of age, it's only about 4 or 5 years ago that you lived in your old life. Now, when you're sort of, you know, 40s or 50s, that's a long time ago. And just like you cannot remember your childhood, or not much of it, so the previous life gets too distant from you to remember. But when you're very young, a young child, it's so recent, your previous life, it's much easier to remember. That's very nice. But, you know, there's so many little kids remember their past lives. Unfortunately, that sometimes that it's a problem for their parents. When they say, you're not my real mummy. You know, you're not my real daddy. Please take me to my real home. It causes trouble for the family. That's why it is usually repressed by the family. Dear Ajahn, have you met any couple who find their partner more caring and loving after they said, I do? Do you know their secrets? It depends what they say, I do what? Yeah, there are partners who are more caring and loving after they say I do, because they use their marriage as a learning process, as a growing process, because it's very difficult to live with another person. It's hard enough to live with yourself. But living with another person is even more difficult. But again, the trick is It's not about you, as I say when I do marriage ceremonies. Marriage ceremony, look at the bride and say, from this moment on, you must not think of yourself because now you're a married woman. And she says, yes. Look at the husband, you must not think of yourself because you're now a married man. He says, yes. And still looking at him, I said, from this moment on, you must not think of your wife. And I look at her and say, from this moment on, you must not think of your husband. And everybody stops because they don't know what this crazy monk is on about. And then, of course, the punchline is, from this moment on, you must not think of yourself, nor must you think of your partner. You must think of us. It's about us now. That's what a marriage is. That's what a relationship is. Not about me. Not about him or her. It's about us. So if there's any problem in the marriage, whose problem is it? They get our problem. You know, the trouble in marriage is a relationship when it's your problem. It's his problem. You should know what he's like. It's his problem. He's really got big problems. It's she. I don't know why I married her. She. I must have been drunk. It's her problem. Or even worse than that, it's my problem. If you pass the problem on or just own the problem yourself, it's wrong. It's our problem. And if you make a relationship, it's about us and our problem, then you can become far more caring because you're becoming more selfless and much wiser. Some people actually do that, and they do a very good job of it. And they can become more caring and loving. And they also understand what love truly is. And it's not that love of just the chemical reaction between a man and a woman. Now we call that like a paper fire. You light a piece of paper, you get this big flame, that's falling in love. It's not really falling in love, it's falling in lust, mostly. And like Shakespeare used to say, it's better to have loved and lost than to never have lost at all. You get that one, you just turn it around a bit. Better let go and lost. But anyway, Shakespeare never said that, it was actually somebody else. But it turns from the paper fire to something much stronger, the wood fire. And from that sort of the original type of romantic love, it becomes more like a friendship love. This is my best friend. And so, you know, I love you no matter where you go, no matter what you do. It turns into that open the door of your heart type of love. Now, darling, we've spent so much time together, we've gone through, we know each other so well. So we've got this incredible friendship. Because where did that friendship come from? You know, you go to school with someone, you go through problems together, you play on the same soccer team together, you get into trouble together. That trouble together and enjoying life together, that creates friendships for life. And that's what happens with the marriage. You become this beautiful friends because you've been through stuff together. And that means the partnership becomes a friendship. A really strong, intimate friendship. And that's actually where it does become very caring and loving. So it can be done. I've seen it done. Many people do it. Oh my goodness me, this is a really big one. Dear Ajahn, you said that doing anapanasati fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. This fulfills the seven enlightenment factors. So, does this mean we only have to sit watching our breath? Or is that an oversimplification? Because the anapanasati goes on to say, they train, I shall breathe in, experience the whole body of breath. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the body formation, the mental formation, experience the mental formation, tranquilizing the mental formation, experiencing the mind, concentrating the mind, liberating the mind, contemplating the mind, and so on. I did this morning. That was the whole talk this morning. Somebody was falling asleep. So, or they were in jhana, they're probably actually doing the jhana rather than actually listening to me talk about it. So is it a simple matter of watching the breath, or is it really very involved? It's there this morning on the talk. I did the Anapanasati Sutta. You start off with the feeling of the breath, the experience of the breath in the first four stages. And as that sort of settles down, then you experience the citta sankhara, the mental formation, which is the vedana. That's why that's part of the second satipatthana, the vedana satipatthana.
you experience a piti sukha, you know, the happiness and joy, and then you experience that, you calm it down. That's experience of the Vedana. And then you experience a citta, which is the nimitta. That's how you experience a nimitta. That's a sign of the citta, the nimitta. That's the ninth part of anapanasati. You don't concentrate it, you still stabilize the citta. And you brighten up the abhipramojjayang citta. And that's actually the what you're doing with your nimitta. And then you free the mind, and that's the jhana experiencing. So I did that this morning. I wrote this before this morning's talk, still confused, not sure how this practice relates to what you said this morning. So listen to it again this morning, and you will find all your answers there, I hope. To the person who asked about grasping sex, please read Cupid's Poison Arrow. What's Cupid's Poison Arrow? I don't know what Cupid's Poison Arrow is, but please read it, whatever it is. And thanks for passing on the message, Ajahn Brahm. Big peace. Okay, there we go. Cupid's Poison Arrow. There's a very good arrow story, and this is one of my favorite ones. So this is going back to practical ways of meditating. And it's a nice story to tell at this time of night. It's the story of the old monk, Don't Lie. Great, you haven't heard this before. Brilliant. Once there was this old monk, and he was wandering from place to place as monks do. And he came to the house of this poor farmer. And the poor farmer gave him his morning meal, his alms food. And the poor farmer said, "Venerable monk, it's soon the start of the 3 months retreat. Have you got a place to stay for the 3 month monsoon retreat?" And the monk said, "Actually, no." And the farmer said, "Oh, please, Venerable Sir, come and stay close to us. Not far from here is a beautiful meadow next to a river. It's so tranquil there. I can build you a very simple hut. And my wife and I, we can feed you every day. It's very simple for us. All we'd ask is for you to come and, you know, teach us a little bit about Buddhism and meditation and maybe look after our kids. Because we're very devout Buddhists, and we won't ask much of you. Can you please come and stay for the 3 months?" And the monk said, "Okay." So for 3 months, they built him a little hut, and he stayed there meditating, and the monk would come and teach him every now and again, and tell him a few stories and jokes, just like I do. You know what monks are like. And the whole family got to love this old monk. He was such a nice, kind, wise old, even the dog loved this old monk. So when the 3 month retreat was over, the monk came and said, "It's time I left now. I've got to carry on my wandering." And the whole family started crying. "So please don't leave us. We miss you so much. You're like part of the family. Please stay." And he said, "No, I've got to go. But," said the monk, "my meditation has been so powerful and deep. And in my meditation, I have discovered that very close by, there is a great treasure hidden underground, and I want you to have it. You're very poor. You made lots of good karma. I want you to be rich." And even though the family was sad they were going to miss the monk, they were very happy they were going to be wealthy. They knew they were going to be wealthy because this came from a monk. And old monks don't lie. But the monk said, "Now you have to follow the instructions very carefully. So listen. Tomorrow morning, you must stand at the threshold of your little hut and wait for the sun to rise. When the sun rises above the horizon, take your bow and arrow. Point the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And when the sun rises, let the arrow fly. Where the arrow falls, there you will find the treasure. And follow the instructions." And the monk left. And that night they hardly slept, because they knew the following day they would find the treasure, because old monks don't lie. So they were there very early with the bow and arrow, waiting for the sun to rise. And when it rose, he made sure he was standing in the threshold of the house. He pointed the bow in the direction of the rising sun. And as the sun rose, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun, and they all raced after it, and
being a man in those days, he made his wife dig the hole. That's bad karma, you know. See what's going to happen next. So the wife dug a hole. She dug it deeper and deeper. And what did she find? Nothing, only trouble. Because that arrow landed in the field which belonged to a rich guy. And the rich man saw them and said, I'm going to arrest you. I'm going to sue you. You can't do this. You've spoilt my land. You can't dig in other people's land. And the poor wife said, it's not my fault. My husband's fault. He told me to dig. And the husband said, not my fault. An old monk told me to dig. And the rich man said, old monk? I'm a Buddhist. And old monks don't lie. What did he tell you? And when he heard the instructions, the rich man said, look, you're just a poor farmer. You've got no muscles on you. I'm a fat, rich man. So look, what I'll do. I will shoot that arrow tomorrow morning. Because I can shoot properly. I've got some strength. And when we find the treasure, because I'm sure we'll find the treasure, because old monks don't lie, we can split the money 50-50. Now, rich minds are like that. They do deals. So the poor man had no choice. So the following morning, the rich man was there. And of course, because of the law of karma, the farmer had to carry the spade and dig the hole this time. So they were there in the morning, waiting for the sun to rise. And as the sun rose, the rich man stood in the threshold of the house. He pointed at the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. And as the sun rose, he shot the arrow and it went much further because he was much stronger, much better fed. And they all ran after it, including the rich man, the farmer, the wife, the kids and the dog as well. They all ran after it. And where the arrow fell, this time the farmer had to dig the hole. He dug deeper and deeper. And what did he find? Nothing, only trouble, because this time it landed in a field belonging to the general in the army. And he came with his soldiers and he saw them digging a hole. He said, what are you doing? You can't do this in my field. And he ordered the soldiers to chop off the people's heads. And before he chopped off the head, the farmer said, it's not my fault. The rich man told me to dig. The rich man said, it's not my fault. The old monk's fault. He told me to find a treasure. And at that, the general told the soldiers, put down your swords. I'm a Buddhist too. What do you mean? Because old monks don't lie. What did he tell you? And when he heard the instructions, the soldier said, ah, look, it's obvious your mistake. You're lay people. You don't know how to shoot bows and arrows. That's my job. He said, look, tomorrow morning, I will shoot that bow and arrow. I'm a soldier. I'm a professional archer. And I'm sure where that arrow falls, we'll find the treasure. And we'll split it three ways, okay? And of course, they didn't have any choice. So the following morning, the general was there with a bow and arrow, together with a rich man, the farmer, his wife, the dog, and the kids. And there, they were waiting for the sun to rise. And when the sun rose, the general, standing at the threshold of the house, raised the bow and arrow, pointed it in the direction of the rising sun, and he shot that arrow. Wow, that was an amazingly powerful shot in a direct line. He was a professional archer. And they all ran after it. This time it was a rich guy's turn to dig the hole. He dug, dug, dug. And what did he find? Nothing, only more trouble. Because this time it landed in the field belonging to the king. And the king arrested them all, including the general. And the king said, it's a capital offense to destroy the king's property. You all have to die. And the general said, it's not my fault. It's that rich man's fault. He said, we'll find a treasure. And the rich man said, not my fault. This farmer started it all. And the farmer said, no, no, it's a monk's fault. And the king said, monk? I'm a Buddhist too. What do you mean? And when they told him the story, the king couldn't understand what went wrong. But he did say, there's something strange here because old monks don't lie. So he said, look, I'll have to put you in jail for a few days until I find that monk and get to the bottom of this. So he sent other soldiers out. And they soon found that monk, arrested him and took him back to the king's palace. And the king interviewed him in front of everybody. Monk, you've caused a lot of problems for a lot of people. Why? And the monk said, because they never followed my instructions. What do you mean, said the king? And the old monk said, your majesty, you come to that house tomorrow morning and you take that bow and arrow and I'll explain it to you. And I guarantee that you will find the treasure tomorrow morning.
because old monks don't lie. And when you find that treasure, please, Your Majesty, divide it four ways equally. Even your portion will satisfy you, let alone how much money will be to a poor farmer. And the king, intrigued, agreed. So the following morning, the king was there at the threshold of the house. And as the sun was about to come up, he stood at the threshold. He looked around to the monk, is that correct? Yes, said the monk, stand at the threshold of the house. Well done. And then he picked up the bow and arrow and he turned around to the monk. The monk said, yes, correct. And he pointed the bow in the direction of the rising sun. He turned around, the monk said, yes, correct. And the sun rose and he was about to shoot the arrow. And the monk said, wrong, Your Majesty. You're not following my instructions. What do you mean? Said the king. Your Majesty, I said to let the arrow fly, not to shoot it. And the king understood. He let the arrow fly, and it dropped right between his feet, exactly where he was standing. And there they dug a small hole and found a huge treasure. And the moral of that story is this. You shoot the arrow of craving over there, or even further. Even if you're an expert archer, you only find nothing but trouble with wanting and craving. So you let the arrow of craving drop. You let go. And where does it fall? Right in this present moment. Right now. Exactly where you're sitting. And there you will find a treasure beyond your wildest dreams. The treasure of contentment, peace, jhana, enlightenment. Drop the arrow of wanting. Let it fly, and it falls right where you are. And it's true, you know. I'm over 60 now. I'm an old monk, and old monks don't lie. Now you know why you don't get into a deep meditation. Flying over here, wanting this, just let it go. Honestly, Lo, I hope you're honest. You're supposed to be keeping precepts. None should be allowed the option to wear T-shirts or sleeveless top under the robe. I wouldn't want to be a nun if it involved such incompassionate rituals. In Buddha's times, none wore sleeveless shirts, did they? I wasn't there at the time. Got photos? Nuns, please raise this issue with your nunnery for the benefit of others. It doesn't bother you. At least the cooler they get, the cooler they are, they can get into jhanas more easily. You reckon? You get cold. Okay, well that's up to nuns' business. I've known as a monk, don't get involved in nuns' business. Whenever I do, I always get into big trouble. So there's monk business and there's nuns' business. And there's lay business and there's, you know, the other monkey business. I don't get into any. So, it's none of my business. So just ask them. At times I struggle with behaviour that has good intent. That's an interesting one. At times I struggle with behaviour that has good intent. Example, a friend of mine was invited to my birthday party. She took it upon herself to ask a friend of mine for a lift who was not invited. How would you handle this one? I'd be, okay, it's great because you know, the more people come to your birthday party, the more presents you get. Does that happen? I don't know. She took upon herself to ask a friend of mine for a lift, who was not invited. Is a friend of yours and you didn't invite him? It's a bit weird. Just invite everybody. And then there's no problem anymore. That's what happened to my birthday party here. 60th birthday, I didn't know who was coming at all. You know, other people invited people to my birthday party. Very glad they invited me as well. It was my birthday party, but No, come on. You struggle with behavior that has good intent. If it's good intent, and they do something and it creates a little bit of a problem or difficulty for you, accept that as part of life. It's fun. Don't be so demanding of things. So always be flexible. And if things go wrong, it doesn't work out the way you intended it to do, and it's different than what you planned, brilliant. So that's how you adapt to things. You know, there's a few people in here who haven't been invited. Well, you can bring along a friend, I don't care. So that's great, just let it happen. Because the thing is, when you're a control freak, you know, you like parties, you have to have certain people coming and certain people aren't invited. That gets very, very difficult sometimes. So yeah, you know, you try and do your best, but it, you know, how you plan things, it never works out that way. Everything I ever planned, well, I never planned to become a monk and a teacher. You know, what my plan was to become like a hermit. Become a monk, find a nice cave, and just be peaceful. I never planned to be spending all my time teaching you guys. But thing never works as planned. I once had this dream. Not a dream, like a fantasy, a monk fantasy. Because, you know, between here and Adelaide, in the Nullarbor Plain, there's all these underground caves. Huge cave systems with lots of water. And when I first heard about that, I said, that's where I want to go. You know, just be a hermit. It's not that hard to get some food, you know, from the local roadhouse. You've got water, it's peaceful, it's cool underneath there. You just live as a hermit in a cave. So I had this dream of being like a real monk hermit. Not seeing anyone, just meditating all day, getting into deep jhanas and having a wonderful time. But then I thought, what would happen? Sooner or later, somebody would find me there. And then they would tell some author who would do a little book about me. Or not an author, maybe just a journalist who put sort of, you know, some article in like the Australian or Sydney Morning Herald or something about the hermit of the Nullarbor. And then Channel 9 would come up with a TV crew. And they do, because it's really interesting, you know, a hermit Nullarbor. Why did you do this? You know, was it because, you know, that you fell in love and your girlfriend dumped you? And they say, you know, did you become a monk to forget? I say, no, see, you've forgotten. It's consistent. And they do an article on you and a TV program. And once it's a matter of interest. I mean, you don't get that many hermits living by themselves. So they do this TV program about you. And once the TV program, then all these buses, these tourists would come, all these Japanese would come and having a picture with the hermit at the Nullarbor. And after all these tourist buses would come, of course they'd have to have no toilets and a little restaurant next to your cave, you know, where they can give Devonshire teas and give souvenirs. You know, I visited the hermit of the Nullarbor. And they'd have these little rocking dolls in there with you. And so the whole fantasy that if you try and be a hermit, you just become another tourist attraction. So I thought, no, just you can never get your own way in this world. So I decided, okay, just whatever you want to do. Just let it happen. So, you know, I didn't become a monk to go on TV and to teach people and go all over the world teaching retreats and stuff like that, but it just happens. So just in life, it's totally unplanned. You know, the way I planned out my life is totally different than the way I planned. Of course not. Well, that's why it's so much suffering. So in the end, you just give it totally up. All your plans and what you expected to do in life. How many of you ever thought, you know, about 10 years ago, 50, 20 years ago, you'd be spending your summer holidays in a retreat center? Getting up early, not eating in the evening, no music, no messing around, sitting on hard floors with sore knees, getting totally frustrated and depressed. Did you ever plan for this? Well, here it is. That's why everything you ever expect in life, it's always something different. That's what the Buddha said. That's one of his great sayings in the Saprissa Sutta. Whatever you expect it's going to be, it will always be different. And when I heard that, that's a brilliant saying. Whatever you expect the future's going to be, it will always be something different than that. So you can't plan anything. And that's actually quite beautiful. It's scary at times, but quite beautiful. So if you don't invite to a party and other people come up, well done, that's life. Parties never work out as expected. And when they don't work out as expected, that's when they become memorable. You know, all the things which go wrong in life, those are the things which make it memorable. I remember going to this ceremony. Every year we have this Commonwealth Day ceremony in the Anglican Cathedral in Perth. It's really as boring as hell. You know, do it. But one year it was really, really good. And that was the year we had a bomb scare. Right in the middle of the ceremony. So the priest came in and the dean, you know, talked to the priest. Something was up. And then he got to the microphone and said, somebody has rang up the police saying there's a bomb in the cathedral because they shouldn't have non-Christians in a Christian cathedral. So we have to evacuate. And that was such a wonderful ceremony because we all had to stop and then we started talking to each other instead of just doing all these ceremonies in front of each other. It was really good fun. And then we came back home, we were all relaxed and told jokes, and instead of doing the usual ceremony, we did it differently because we had to adapt. I told the dean afterwards, he said, can we do this every year, please? Because when it goes wrong, that's when it comes alive. I remember some of my favorite funerals, the best funeral I ever went to. It was this committal at Fremantle, on the external committal. And the lady still comes. I saw her last Friday at Jenny over in Nollamara. Her husband, Steve, died when he was young, but he was a whitewater rafter. And I told her, maybe I shouldn't have told her this, but it's true, you can make your own coffin. You don't have to have it just, you know, off the shelf. You can make your own. And because he was a whitewater rafter, they're made in the shape of a boat, you know, with paddles on the top. And what a beautiful send-off, you know. You like boats, you go off in a boat. The trouble was they made it out of this very heavy hardwood called Jarrah. It was the right size, but totally overweight. So when they put it on that little conveyor thing, which actually goes through and the thing opens and closes afterwards, the thing was so heavy, the poor conveyor belt couldn't actually take it through. So it only went halfway through when the screen jammed against it. And it couldn't move. Halfway in, halfway out. And you should have seen the look on the funeral director's face. You know, his worst nightmare had happened. The funeral had all gone wrong. And his coffin was stuck. And then what the wife did, you know, the grieving widow, she got up on the coffin off the conveyor belt and started pushing. And they all said, you really want to get rid of him, don't you? And then it descended into total chaos. One of his friends said, yeah, you know, the first day he got a car, he crashed it. Look, the same with his coffin. The first day in his coffin, he crashes his coffin too. Just like him. And it turned out to be totally ridiculous. Some people went outside and trying to pull it through, and the funeral director was trying to push it back. And it didn't go according to plan at all. That was the best funeral I've ever been to. Everyone still talks about it. Wow, that was a funeral to remember. Why not? Or the marriage. I remember the marriage I remember the most. There was no Dennis Shepherd, our president. Well, we did this marriage up at Yanchep. We did all the nice thing, all the stories, and then, I now pronounce you man and wife. And they said, Dennis, you forgot the rings. He hadn't given the rings and exchanged the rings yet. He'd forgotten it. So to pronounce them man and wife, and they hadn't any rings on their fingers yet. They said, oops, sorry. So I had to start again. That was a really great marriage, though. I always remember that one. This is hilarious. You know, you've got to exchange rings in a marriage. And he did everything else, but he forgot that part. So I love it when those things happen, when everything goes wrong. Isn't that beautiful in life? When things don't go according to plan, but they go according to life. Just like me going over time. It's now 9:38, so I better go quick. So thank you all for listening. See you tomorrow, same time, same place. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.